If you're hearing this, it means that you're subscribed to the public podcast feed and only getting part of the conversation. If you'd like to listen to the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Welcome to the Howl in the Wilderness podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. Howl in the Wilderness features deep and insightful conversations with renegade artists, philosophers, psychologists, and spiritual teachers who are working on the edge of dominant culture to recover and revive soul in people and the planet. On this episode, I speak with Steven Eisenstadt, who I had the pleasure of learning with a couple years ago when I participated in his dream tending program. Steven Eisenstadt is the founder of Pacifica Graduate Institute, Dream Tending, and the Academy of Imagination. For more than 35 years, he has explored the power of dreams through depth psychology. He has collaborated with Joseph Campbell, Marion Woodman, Robert Johnson, James Hillman, and Native elders worldwide. Steve and I have a wide-ranging conversation where we talk about the power of imagination to heal individuals and restore the soul of the world. Steve and I have a wide-ranging conversation where we talk about the power of imagination to heal individuals and restore the soul of the world, and we pay homage to some of the spiritual mentors who he's worked with over the years and who have deeply inspired me. As usual, this episode is made possible through the generous support of the Howl in the Wilderness Patreon community. If you'd like to enjoy early access of full ad-free episodes and access the archive of the first 100 episodes of the podcast, please consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Steve Eisenstadt, hey, thanks so much for doing the podcast. It's been a long time coming, and I'm really glad we could make it happen.
I am delighted to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too. Talking about probably my favorite subject, the imagination. So just fill people in a little bit. I took your dream tending course. A couple of years ago, but it feels like a lifetime, you know, kind of post-pandemic concept of time. But it was wonderful. And I was just reflecting this morning, like one of the things that I kind of miss most about it was having this little cohort that would get together every week, kind of outside of the class, but we would do some dream tending together. And I was reflecting that when I had that kind of group, or when I've worked with a therapist, and there's the intention to tend to dreams, that the dreams come more strongly, and I am able to retain them better. And if I don't have that, I find it more difficult to bring something back from the dream world. And I'm wondering, just like off the top, if you found that to be true, or is it like helpful to have the intention to work on dreams with someone else to share it out? Does that help with the dreams?
It does, and pretty significantly so. You know, it's really good to be in a community of people that are like-minded, that are sharing dreams with one another. I think it's almost like a good friend. You know, when you develop a friendship with somebody, then you begin to deepen your contact, your communication, you're in conversation. The same with dreams. When they know that we're paying attention, then in turn, they will present themselves back to us. And really, I think actually, in the imagination, in the dream time, we are offered figures, landscapes, you know, different motifs, animals, persons that we recognize, some that we don't. I mean, it's a whole inner community. And when we are involved in an outer community, it's really helpful in that we can then experience almost the confluence between the inner community and the outer community. And it's like a welcome mat. Welcome. And even the frightening dreams, because that's what's up a lot in the world of today. People are having more and more nightmares and, you know, images that are somewhat horrific at times, not always, but often. And it's helpful to be in a supportive community. It really is an invitation for the dreams to present, share themselves, to be known. And then we have the skills and the support to respond. Yeah, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I'm counseling people and wanting to bring some dreams into our work together, you know, people often say that they're not dreaming or they're not retaining anything from dreams. And so I say one of the good first steps is to get a special little journal and put it by your bedside. And I think that acts as like a signal to the psyche that I'm listening. And then the dreams might start to come. But also, yeah, having someone else that you're going to share the dreams with, a community or another person, also signals like, okay, I'm not like the dream maker, you know, whatever is creating the dream, whoever's creating the dream is going, okay, well, there's going to be more people listening now. So it's like feeding it into the world through the person, I think.
I think so. And even people listening to us have this conversation about dreams, that perks interest, right? Now we're curious. And therefore, tonight, you know, before going to sleep, just as you're saying, a journal next to the bed, that's a suggestion, that's an offering. And saying three times, tonight, I'm going to remember my dreams. You know, it's just very easily, simply. First, sleep comes more easily that way. And then in the morning, before the world comes in, you know, before we reach over for the cell phone, before we rehearse the agenda for the day and all the, you know, obvious responsibilities that we have, you know, the different commitments that we need to be responsive to, before all that fills the mind, to stay in what's called liminal space, that place between awake and sleeping, that space, and just pause and listen, let the dreams come. When they know they're being welcomed and they know that there's a journal and in turn know that there's people that we're going to share them with, it's really remarkable how they do respond and that we do have the capacity to hear, listen, to write them down. And even if we just get a bit, you know, because that's what happens a lot. We don't get the whole thing, but remember a hint or just a little segment. Once we start writing that down, you know, or doodling, because not everybody writes a narrative, just a little picture or sketch. It's remarkable how often more of the dream will follow and be remembered and be offered to us. So it is a praxis and it's really rewarding as well. You know, it is. There's so much wisdom and guidance that's offered through the world of dream that it has its own reward. So once we start and we feel the benefit, then we have a certain kind of motivation to keep on going.
Yeah, it becomes kind of self-motivating. Mm-hmm. In that way, you know, there's a lot of interest in psychedelics these days, and I do a lot of counseling with people who are working with psychedelics. And what I'm continually telling people is that if you open up this channel between you and the dream world, you're having a psychedelic journey every night of your life.
Yeah.
And if you're not paying attention to your dreams, like, what a missed opportunity. I mean, if you're interested in the other world or the inner world, however you conceive of it, the door is open every night.
The door is open. And so much of my new work is exploring dreams as portals, opening doors that extend into the different realms of psyche, the realms of consciousness. It is really the capacity to journey into deep imagination. And dreams really offer that in and of themselves. You know, there is a certain autonomy of imagination that presents itself through dreams. So already, just like you're saying, you know, we're in an altered state of consciousness, a different state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And two, when we bring awareness to the dreams themselves, in addition to associating them to the events of the day, which is important, or amplifying them and really understanding how the wisdom stories through the archetypal mythic motifs come forward, also really helpful and supportive. In addition to those more familiar possibilities and opportunities, it's possible to be in the dream time, to really bring a presence, a witnessing presence to the dream, and notice in the dream itself, inevitably, variably, there is an opening, a portal that leads from the dream into the different ranges of, you know, qualities of conscious realms of experience that are very similar to journeying.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Yeah, it seems like the new work that you're focusing on with the imagination matrix is really an extension from the dream tending work and bringing the imaginal world into more into the waking life and learning how to access imagination at any time. Okay, so let's get into something that I love pondering. It's kind of the ontology of the imagination. Now, for you, how do you conceive of the imagination or the imaginal? Do you see it as a kind of another metaphysical reality, like another world next to this one? Is it all happening in the psyche? Like, so where do you come from with this?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And continuously we ponder that question and come at it in different ways. I think the biggest difference from the more familiar traditional orientation to imagination is that in my direct experience and so many people that I'm working with, imagination has an autonomy of its own. It really does. It has its own existence. It's a quality of consciousness with a life of its own. And that changes things, because for us to access imagination, appreciating that the figures and the landscapes, like in a dream, the creatures, you know, the feelings, what we experience there, have their own autonomy, their own living presence. Then we get to journey through those realms and get to know the neighborhood, right? Get to know the figures. The upside, the true benefit, is that a lot of these figures and these landscapes have stories to tell. They do. They, you know, they have information to offer and to share. And I don't want to make it romantic or idealistic. I mean, you know, we can talk about a little bit about there's upsides and downsides, but in psychology, there's shadow sides and there are abundant positive and generative sides. But even in the shadow experiences, there's when we bring the capacity to really befriend, which we can talk about if you like, we can really experience the, you know, the spark of possibility that's there. And what is so helpful in my work with myself first and with others is that we learn a lot about who I learn, personalize, learn a lot about who I am, not who I'm expected to be, not the script that I grew up with, not the set of expectations that's coming from culture or workplace or even family for that matter. No, that authenticity, you know, the authentic quality of personhood, you know, what's being asked of me now? You know, what is that authentic diamond? It's in Greek, that calling, that yearning, the desire, the deeper desire. How does that show up? And what's it asking of me in this moment in time, in my life? And very practically, in my married life, in my relationship life, in my collegial life, right? In my business experiences, you know, not necessarily all out there, always applied in the actuality of how I conduct my life. So imagination, coming back to your question, has its own life, and it is filled with the kind of wisdom teaching, right? And we have the opportunity to meet the people that we've known, our elders, our ancestors, right? We get to know them more fully because they are present there, as so many traditions in the world suggest. And to the next generations often will make an appearance. There's a hint of what's becoming there. And I think the takeaway for me, actually, because every morning for me, now let's say 6 out of 7 days, I will take the time to first record dream, look for the portal, and then journey into imagination. When I do that, my day is very different, right? I feel a sense of belonging. I do. A belonging to the figures that I've gotten to know, to the landscapes, the places of imagination. I have a sense of belonging, also a sense of coming home, home to who I am. And even the word I surrenders to the we, the many that are part of the imagination, right? And the day is different. It is, you know, how I work is different. How I present myself is different. From presenting at the United Nations to a world audience, to offering a big seminar, like we were just talking about in China, to being an administrator in an institution, how I work is informed by not only a different felt sense, but by the others that I'm sharing, you know, my life experience with, the inner figures of imagination. I know it's a little long-winded, but it touches my heart when you ask that question, the nature of imagination.
Yeah. I think like part of it for us moderns, like where imagination has been like denigrated in a way to be just a things that we think up with our mind. I think we have to kind of rehabilitate our language around imagination. And so one of the ways I do that is I think about, you know, imagination is a faculty that allows us to enter into the imaginal, which, like you were saying, seems to have its own autonomy and timeline. Like when you dip into imagination, you find that, oh, these figures have been carrying on without me. And if it's been a while, you might go, oh, wow, this figure who I've known before has changed. Things have happened in my absence. And that's remarkable.
All right. Since you went there, let's go one more step. Because I just, you know, I work a lot in different workshops, different settings. Actually, I'm privileged to be able to work with just a small group of people at Pacifica Graduate Institute, which I founded now 50 years ago. It's our 50th anniversary. And I love that. So we'll have just 15 people. I just got back from Montana where I hosted 15 people, 16 people. I love that group size. And we are in community, you know, over 4 or 5 days, 3 or 4 days. And we do meet the figures there. And what came up, particularly in Montana, with people were thinking about, hey, getting older, right? Death made an appearance, always does, particularly in the world of today. Death is very up and out loud. Of course, instinctively, our animal bodies is going to push that away because that's something we want to avoid for obvious reasons. And two, as we know, you know, when we really companion death in a different way, the image of death, the actuality of death, we know that it surrenders fear and informs life. It does, you know. And when we have a relationship with death, what we discover is, hey, death is present at all points in life. I mean, that's what the Greek mythology, the myth tells us, that it's contiguous with life at all points. Where that became interesting in response to the question and your experience is that the people that we've known, you know, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my grandma, people have been so important in my life. You know, when I'm with them in imagination, I can appreciate that they're still in their journey, right? And they are changing, right, to what you were noticing. They are in psychology, in Jungian depth psychology, the word is individuation. You know, they're evolving. So to the extent that we can bring ourselves into a sustained relationship with them, we notice their evolution as well. And as they evolve, go through their changes, we're implicated. So do we. And if we're not engaged with the imagination, we don't touch into that realm, that actuality. Obviously, in certain traditions, there is a day set aside every year where you get to know your people, your ancestors and your elders, and you actually, you know, offer song and poetry and well wishes, even foods. And there's a ritual, a celebration of the dead. But, you know, because our culture has left imagination for the most part, and we only have it, as you said, concocted, it's a different kind of rational mind generated imagination, we miss out on that. And it's really important, I think, in family life, in personal life, to re-engage and get to know and remember them, particularly mm-hmm. elders and ancestors, even when they were really difficult in awake life experience. I mean, you know, I've been a therapist and a clinician also for about 30, 40 years. It's not all good. In fact, it's very mm-hmm. tricky with different kinds of abuse or addiction or trauma. So it's not always easy to reacquaint. They too, though, when we learn the skill set, they too can discover their authenticity, you know, not the addictive process or the traumatic process that they in turn most usually have gone through and then pass that on. But they have the opportunity when we befriend to discover their authentic possibility. And as they do, they journey and change. And as that happens, we journey and change and become part of a bigger story. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just listening to an old talk by Maladoma Somme about dealing with the troublesome ancestors, you know, people that we had troubles with in during their lifetime. And he was talking about the change of relationship once they pass on and how it allows forgiveness, because there's a kind of separation that's happened, distancing from the events that happened in their lifetime. And maybe we could see the suffering soul that is trying to individuate, and through engaging with them, help them to individuate or evolve or heal. And in that is our own healing as well. Yeah,
so true. And it's, you know, and again, it's not simple. It is not. I mean, it takes, that's why where we started with community. It takes community. It takes support, right, and protection to really return to that relationship. It does. And with the support and the protection and the care, and particularly with community, either another person or a group of people, it's possible to re-engage, right? Re-engage and really experience. I call that in the new book that I wrote, Imagination Matrix, you know, to transmute those what are very difficult figures, personas, and the easy one that everybody gets, the little children from 2 years old is Star Wars, right? It's perfect. You got a Darth Vader figure, which is the horrific, right? The catastrophic. Mm-hmm. But to reacquaint with support, guidance, right? Community. And then figuring out the ways to encounter. And then to appreciate that beneath the mask is something else. A life not lived, a life interrupted, really co-opted. And the rediscover, as Luke did, his father was changed life. As his father shifted, so did he. As his father was liberated to journey forward and to realize or individuate, evolve, so did Luke. Right? And that story, that was a story that Lucas got from Joe Campbell, which I could share with you. It's a big story. Because Joseph Campbell was coming to Pacifica in those early years of Pacifica. So I got to know him really well in a lot of different ways. And when he went up to the ranch, Skywalker Ranch, and worked with Lucas, who forever now, George Lucas forever credits Joseph for that inspiration. Just notice where that's gone. Not only Star Wars 1, 2, 3, and then pre-1, 2, 3, and then post-1, 2, 3, but about 15 different spin-offs for all ages. So the story is universal, worldwide. So we have access. We have visual opportunity to notice how this can work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's something, you know, in doing the imaginal work. Well, there's a lot in what you said. One of the things that's coming up for me is You know, I had a question here, like, what do you think the benefits are of doing imaginal work? But you've touched on quite a few things, I think, already, and I just want to highlight them. So one of them is you're talking about when you start to engage with dreams first thing in the day and then to work with those figures through imaginal work, the whole kind of tone and quality of your day changes. Like, you're not entering into your day alone. You've got this whole inner community of figures kind of by your side, or they got your back, or they're leading you forward. You know, it can have all these different influences on us. And I think that's so important, because as modern people, disconnected from the imaginal and from rituals, we have, of course, a kind of epidemic of loneliness. And I think, you know, that's often said, well, it's because we're so disconnected in our communities and we're more isolated and this kind of thing. But what's left out of the kind of the broader conversation is the kind of absence of these inner figures. And you're addressing that through your work. And I appreciate that, because I think it's integral. We can be alone, yet not lonely, if we have a connection to the ancestors and all these inner figures that we're speaking of.
And then we're curious, and then we're engaged. And it's really not possible to be authentically curious and engaged with these inner figures and hyper anxious or depressed.
Despondent, so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the same time, we're not. And we're part of a bigger story that is evokes curiosity, evokes interest, plus the resources. There's guidance. So yeah, we do feel supported in a very different way. And I think that is the takeaway, right? If there is any takeaway from my point of view, because when I'm working with people in isolated depression or very agitating anxiety, there's all things that I've learned all through the years, from medicines to treatment modalities to behavioral interventions, all helpful and useful and have a place. They do. They mm-hmm. do. In addition, though, to evoke curiosity, to get to know the figures of imagination, something else becomes possible, just like we're talking about. And that evokes, in turn, curiosity. And when curiosity is open and we're starting to engage, then when we're walking down the street, you know, wonder begins to happen. Mm-hmm. We're in a waking dream to a certain extent, and things do change. Yeah.
And it helps interpersonally too, right? Like, if I have interest and curiosity in my own inner life, then when I meet another person, I may be interested in what's going on under the surface for them and not get caught up in the kind of surface presentation. Like, you know, you said with Darth Vader, I might not just be caught by the mask, but I might start to get curious about what's underneath the mask. And perhaps there's some pain and suffering there. And that's why I'm getting this kind of unpleasant presentation, you know? And so then compassion and empathy grows with imagination.
Yeah, empathy grows, interest and curiosity, you're right. Mm-hmm. I don't get triggered so quickly. Like, that's just a reaction, which I don't discount. I mean, you know, when we've mm-hmm. suffered in life and things were tough, particularly for a little, and or growing up through the years and the decades, there'll be behaviors that just trigger us and we're gone. 24 to 48 hours, we're caught in it. We're just, to take that step back, like you're saying, and that's what happens by having the many figures, walking not only by myself, reactive, you know, we'll scan and we'll just avoid that trigger, you know, but we're using a lot of energy to scan to avoid, right? We're in a reactive mode. The other possibility is to really walk along that same street, meet different people in a responsive versus a reactive way. And the way to do that is to be in the company of these others. It's true. So that we feel that I'm not there just alone, that I have the figures that I've known and that I attend to and I befriend every morning, three mornings a week, that I come back to dream and imagination, getting to know them so they're by my side. I mean, it really does change our way of being in the world, for sure. Mm-hmm. That.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, as you speak about that, how having these figures by our side as we go through the day, I'm reminded of a book by, oh my gosh, why is his name escaping me right now? No, it escaped my mind, but I'll think about it later. I'll put it in the comments. Yeah. But one of the main characters was, I think, Puerto Rican. He comes from a religious background that is from the Yoruba tradition. So he has a connection with all these orishas. Wow. And so you're inside his experience. And as he goes about his day going on these adventures, he would call upon different orishas to help him bring some kind of strength or a kind of stealthiness, you know, whatever was required. He had this whole pantheon of figures to draw on to help him, to help support him in whatever he was doing on his adventure. And I thought it was a great illustration of how this could work for anyone, because it's kind of pan-cultural, and these figures come to us in different dress according to our own background and experiences and who we are. You have any thoughts about that? How, like, religion and those of us who might not be connected to a tradition like that can still find those kind of supportive figures?
Oh,
are we
yeah,
talking that, about that, the same thing?
Yeah, we are, and it's the body of my work and my offering to people in the world, and the workshops that I do, individual work that I do, even when I'm in a bigger context, you know, in a corporate context or a international context, always reminding that, hey, we have access to these figures, and they are like supportive figures at times. They really can accompany us into our relationships with others or with institutions, with colleagues. You know, I was just back from Zurich, and I was consulting with a corporate entity. So this is a founding CEO and his leadership team. And I won't mention the name, but everybody would recognize it's, you know, very well established. And, you know, they were concerned. Something was not working any longer. You know, the passion had gone out, the desire had gone out. And then you translate that into the workplace was not fluid, not smooth. There was lack of creativity, innovation. You keep going in the business model. And what do? You lose your competitive edge. You can see why I was invited. But so, you know, when you're doing it through ego, when you're doing it, the work through a certain kind of mandate or certain set of expectations, one thing happens. When you invite the others to be part of it, like most of them had done from the very beginning, that's what brought them to this company, right? They had ideas and they were creative and innovative. And it's kind of like imagining the muse, you know, having a figure like a muse or a beloved or a figure that is really going to push a little bit. You know, when you get to know that group, that company of others, it really does change your life. And it's great to be able to, just as you're sharing, walking down the street and really noticing, hey, who's journeying now along with me? Who's visiting now? Just getting to know the many figures of imagination or of psyche or whatever we're going to offer name. But really does create the capacity to feel the accompaniment of others and their resources. And their resources, in turn, really inspire, support, and resource us as we're engaged with others, whether it's a company or a friendship.
Mm-hmm. The author, by the way, is William Gibson, great Canadian science fiction author. The other thing that I was thinking about while you're speaking about some of the, you know, what it gives us, this connection to the imaginal and to our dreams. You mentioned Joe Campbell, and both him and Jung felt that it was really important that we each find our personal myth. I think Jung at the end of his life said it was the most important question for us to ask is, what is the myth that we're living? And through his deep imagination work, he discovered that he was had this call and this destiny and these soul companions. So the only way I can think of how to find our personal myth is to go into a kind of mythic realm, which is the realm of imagination and symbols and all of that, right?
I think so, yeah. To really invite the stories back into our life. I mean, I'm now doing a project working with 1-year-old to 5-year-old. Children's play, right? They're already in imagination. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're born, it's a blueprint that we're born with, imagination. And what happens so quickly, unfortunately, in most instances, is we get conditioned out of that maybe way too quickly, you know, and then we're asked to study for the test, we're asked to be assessed, we're evaluated on certain criteria, and the imagination with its own spontaneity and autonomy starts to wane. The myth that we're living by begins to wane, and we are now, you know, either part of the programmer's code, you know, if we're putting too much time into social media, or part of parental expectations or institutional, et cetera, et cetera. So to remember the spontaneity of imagination and what is offered there, I think is everything. And you, from the 1 to 5-year-olds, go to Jung. Actually, this summer, I'm leading a small group of people, a little tour, and we're going to start in Zurich and then go through and visit Jung's personal home and his tower. And then we're going to go to Eranos, where Jung and the whole group of people were doing all that kind of work on imagination and so on. And I'll never forget the last time I was at Jung's home, I got permission from their family because I've gotten to know them through the years. You can go to his study, right? In the home itself, they limit it only to a small group of people. And you see, you know, yeah, during the day, there was the day job, right? And, you know, he was writing, he was offering scholastic lectures and doing professional conferences, and he had a clientele, and he's working with patients, he's working at a psychiatric hospital. I mean, he's doing a lot of things. He had family obligations. Then what happened is night came. Let's say 9 o'clock, I don't know the exact time, but night came and he separated and he went up into the office, the very office that we've been invited to go visit, which is really wonderful. And you see that there he was writing and doing something else, you know, and he was working kind of with dreams, but actually he was allowing the spontaneity of his imagination to just present itself, just full on. The images that were coming forward, you know, the ones that were difficult and challenging, the ones that were beloveds, the ones that were guides. I mean, the whole variety of the figures that come forward. That's why child's play is so helpful. Kids do that all the time. They have imaginary friends, right? We just get that stopped. But to be able to allow that to continue, something different happens. So he's working. And so a lot of people know the reference that I'm about to cite. He's working in a journal. A journal that was never meant to be made public, just private. He was working with the many places and figures and the many selves, let's say. And he created what was come to be known as the Red Book that was published right after the family had a big conversation and a lot of talk, and they discovered, yes, we're going to allow this to be released into the world. So when I'm working in workshops and working with people, I offer them the idea of creating your own Red Book. You know, just create the journal like we were talking about. It's great to be in community. It is. To be in small communities where people are collaborating with one another. But to make sure that there's that alone time, that time that allows for the figures of imagination to present and them to be sketched and to be doodled. I mean, it's a trip to be at his home because not only was he doing it in his journals, but right outside in the yard, right? He was sculpting and he was painting and he was crafting. It filled with things. But that became his touchstone, you know, his guidance. And that's what he passed on now to the next generations to pick up. Yeah. Mm.
I think that's a really interesting point, just to recognize that when we're young, we all have like unhindered access to the imaginal realm. And as we grow up, we're expected to grow out of these fantasies, you know, like get, you know, exile your imaginary friends. You know, for me, I had a whole room full of these stuffed animals, and each one had a different personality and kind of role in my life. You know, the protector lion and, you know, the funny little frog or whatever. And at some point it was expected that I was to clear them all out, you know, bag them up, put them on the curb. And we kind of exile these imaginary figures from our life. And so part of restoring the imaginal capacity is kind of reawakening the inner child. And Jung did that. I think, you know, at Bollingen, he was out there by the lakeside building little stone forts and castles and things like that. And so he had his kind of playtime. And then a part of that was all this deep imagination work that was really, he considered it the foundation of all the other work that he did. Mm-hmm. And just interesting to note that most of what we know about Jung's imaginal life doesn't come from his recorded dreams. I think we get a few of those over the years, some of the big dreams, but most of it came through this alternative state of consciousness, deep imagination work, you know, what he ended up calling active imagination. I like to call it interactive imagination.
Yes, right? Because, you know, that idea, active imagination, that's been literalized and translated into something like guided imagery.
Yeah.
Active imagination, which is what you're noticing. What he meant was not active imagination, something that we do to imagination. He's suggesting that the imagination in and of itself is active, and that we then follow and listen and witness the activities of imagination, interactive, like you're suggesting. And at Bollingen, I was blessed to be with a family member and to go. It's a tower along the lakeside, and it's where he would go, and other family members would go during the summertime. No electricity, no, just a place to retreat, you know. And I'll never forget, you know, visitation is really only allowed for the first floor for the most part. Mm. And it's got, you know, it's just out of them.
How enticing would that be? Like, no, you can't go up the spiral staircase. That's verboten.
Verboten. I befriended, you know, and I don't know.
I'd be slipping on bribes. And
oh, I don't know. Everybody left that we were there to have the celebration or this remembrance. That's just the two guys. I guess I can tell the story. So, you know, people left. The caterers had put stuff out on the ground where people, you know, on the yard side where people were. And you're right, there are little statuettes everywhere. And even the tower itself is crafted with figures. I mean, it's just really an animated place. Everybody left. The person I was with, you know, as a child, was part of the family, grew up there. So that was for him a play place. Mm-hmm. He said, "Steve, stay back." Oh, you know, I said, being very conscientious, because I was one of the leaders of the group. No, my promise, listen, this is my space, stay back. Caterers leave, two bottles of champagne he pulls out before they leave. He takes one, hands me one, let's go. I go, okay. I have to say, I only took one half of a sip of the champagne. I was, you know, still just high from being there. We go up the stairwell, right? And it was amazing. And sure enough, you know, on like the third level, remember, there are no lights, so we were with the candles, really. And the beautiful moon was coming right off the lake, so it was illuminated. And wouldn't you know, on that level four, there is a floor-to-ceiling depiction of Philemon. Okay, I knew Philemon from the Red Book, because that was the cover. And I thought, this was a different, exactly the same in the sense, but a really individualized depiction with different words. Well, the moon was coming through. My friend was giddy and he was up top level saying, come on, we have more to experience, which we did. We went up and did all that, but I didn't. I stayed there for about 30, 40 minutes. in that kind of trance place that we get when something way out of the ordinary and extraordinary happens. I must say, I think I experience more of the heart and soul of Jungian psychology in that hour or so than I have. And of course, I've been privileged to study with and collegially engage with some of the finest analysts in the world, actually. But just to be there and to feel the field of how images come forward and are presented, yes, I just, it was quite something. And it wasn't through dream, just like you were sharing. It was through just being involved in imagination and taking the time and creating the place and having the space to be responsive to imagination's revelation and presentation.
Well, I mean, it seems like everything that we're talking about is in some way about dissolving the distance between what we conceive of as this world and the imaginal. And so they start to overlap and maybe even emerge. And so we realize that life is but a dream in a way.
Yeah, isn't that the takeaway? When you're in the field of imagination, life is like a dream. And we name that waking dreams. It's as if we're in a waking dream state. Does it mean that I am distant or that I am out there in woo-woo land or something? Just the opposite, actually. You know, I feel more engaged. I feel present. Oh, my goodness. There's two ways for me to walk in the hills here in Santa Barbara where I live or be in the ocean here in Santa Barbara. One way is to walk up these hills with an agenda. Okay, what do I need? It's a problem solving. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a problem I need that needs attention, or I need to get my, you know, my steps in.
Right, yeah. The pragmatic.
That's one way of doing it, right? And the other way of doing it is to pause, let go of the rational mind, evoke curiosity. Curiosity, right, brings imagination. And I'm walking and, you know, I hear things that I would never otherwise hear. The birds singing in the trees, the wind going through the leaves, it's the creek. And then you get curious. So it happens to me when I'm up in the Sierras each summer too. And I get curious. And then I follow that, right? You're just following the path of imagination. And it's amazing what awakens. I mean, the landscape itself starts to animate and come alive, which it is from the beginning, truthfully. And then we get drawn to a place, and then we sit, and then we listen, and then imagination comes, inspiration comes, innovation comes. Even the hardest of problems that I carry in my life, in that context, the perspective shifts. And I see things from different ways. And those soul companions that we were talking about, those figures of imagination, they become present. What I do is hold a little council, which means that I invite these figures of imagination, these what I name soul companions, to be present. And I'll even gather things like a little rock or a stick or a leaf after asking permission and put them around and just sit. Not the center, not the director, not the conductor. No, that's the ego mind. No, I sit as one of the many in the council praxis and just listen and allow and befriend and remember that, you know, we're all here with in this place of imagination, each with a voice, each with a presence, each with a story and wisdom and guidance to share.
Yeah, when the self, the ego, the I is but one voice in a chorus or a community or an inner council, it's quite a relief. It's a relieving of the burden of autonomy, you know? Like the ego doesn't have to shoulder all the responsibility for what next, you know, what to do with life. And so the ego can like relax a little bit, you know?
Yeah, truly, one of the many, you know, it's funny because dreams share that with us every night. We dream every night, two or three times, actually, a night. I mean, we're not always remembering them, but we go into that activity. And dreams will come. And, well, I don't know, 70, 80% of the time when people remember dreams with figures, they'll see themselves, the figure that looks like me in the dream. And that's been named in psychology the dream ego. But as James Hillman, a favorite of both of ours, I think, who's a depth psychologist and did a lot of writing and was at Pacifica many times over, when you notice that the dream ego is in the dream, you know, you wonder, if it's the I that's in the dream, who's dreaming the dream? And then it becomes a very curious question. Who is dreaming the dream if it's not me? Well, it may be all the others that are in the dream that are dreaming the dream with me being part of it. So we change perspective and change context. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just reminded of something that Hillman said about how the tendency to take a dream and interpret it, you'd call it like, it's like fulfilling the agenda of Captain Ego. It's like wrestling the dream from the underworld into the day world and making a claim on it, and kind of wrapping it up in a interpretation, and in a way disempowers the dream, takes away its autonomy. And but I just love that Captain Ego. And that's kind of just a funny way to think about this tendency to take ownership and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's dream analysis, dream interpretation. I mean, there is a place for sure. There is for that. It's just that there's something in addition. I name that dream tending, to tend to dream. So the Captain Ego is not fully in charge. Right? The dream itself has happened. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, when the newer edition of Dream Tending, to tend a dream, just was released. Hmm. And it's just the skills and the, you know, the tools that we can use to tend rather than to explain the dream, to allow the dream to speak on behalf of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the things that I appreciated taking that course with you, is you took a lot of these ideas that Hillman had. You know, Hillman was very kind of anti-structure, like you could call him a... he didn't like kind of programs and systems and things like that, right? And so that's just part of his personality, and I love that about him. But it also leaves us with, like, well, how do we like put this into practice? And so one of the things I appreciate about your work is that you said, well, look, yes, we want to like hold all of these things lightly, but here are some like guidelines on how to tend to dreams in this way that's not serving just Captain Ego's agenda. And so did you ever feel like a bit of a conflict in taking a more kind of process-oriented approach to this stuff? Like, did you ever have Hillman over your shoulder going, hey, careful, it's getting close to a system there? You know, did you ever have that experience?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, in the morning I have a praxis, and one of the things I do in that praxis is to go into remembrance of elders. So Marion Woodman, who I was very close with, and James Hillman and Joe Campbell, and a variety of people in my life. So he's very much a presence, you know, and I hear his voice a lot. So I do hear that. I have no, you know, we've walked on the beach many times as well. So I don't, in fact, what is true is that he was so helpful in the formulation, in the evolution of Pacifica. He was very helpful. I mean, available all day, during the night, whenever I make a call, he would respond, you know. And he was anti-organization, anti-hierarchy. His work when we teach in the classroom.
Didn't want a school.
Didn't want a school. He's contradictory. It is the whole thing. And I'll never forget. At first he said, no. I don't want an institution, Steve. I don't think that's correct. And I was bummed out. You know, 2 years passed. We go walking on the beach again. And I said, you know, and he said, you know what? I've had a change of thinking. I do want to support you, the work, and Pacifica under one condition. I said, okay. You know, I'm pretty wide-eyed at that point and just beginning it all. And he said, just promise me one thing. I said, what's up? When you choose faculty, you know, and even students, make sure that you choose the most odd, peculiar faculty and students that you can. Make sure they're odd. That's the most important part. Make sure they're odd. and students as well. And then he would help me identify those foundational faculty that were part there. They were odd. They were, all of us were odd, peculiar. So we kind of kept out of the conformity and Captain Ego's place as much as possible. And now his work is at the Opus Archives and Library, his full collection of work, and people are going to have access and research and like this. But when we teach his work, he's brilliant. And, you know, he writes from a place where you have to really read it poetically as much as literally to really appreciate the beauty and the genius that moves through his idea, his ideation, his work, his words, his advocacy.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Well, it explains, you know, why I feel such an affinity for Pacifica and the people who teach there and come out of there, because we're all odd ducks, and it's it's like an oasis of nonconformity and eccentricity, which are things that Hillman really celebrated, and one of the reasons why I love him, and he feels like a kind of spiritual elder to me.
Yeah, me too.
And he's come to me in my dreams before and kind of affirmed certain things for me and given me like a bit of a confidence, like a little bit of a boost, going, yeah, go with it.
Yeah, nice. Isn't that great? See, there is a soul companion, right? Mm-hmm. A figure of imagination now, an imaginal James Hillman, who is as live and vital as could be in that realm of experience, to then offer support and inspiration and affirmation. It's great to be connected with these figures. Yeah.
Well, this is a good place to ask this. I was thinking about, in your book, you talk about Jung, Hillman, and Marion Woodman as kind of key figures that influenced your approach that you developed. And I'm interested, like, what do you think each of them offers, our modern understanding of imagination and imaginal work? Like, they each, I think, offer something a little different or more or extra.
They do, I think. At least for me, I'll put it in my direct experience. Marion brings body and soul, psyche and soma. She does, you know, and she brought that to Zurich when the group was just forming, you know, the second generation of Jungian-oriented analysts. And at the beginning, her work was pushed away, to be honest about it. And then something began to emerge, you know, bringing that quality of what she was calling the feminine, not necessarily connected only to women, females per se, that whole quality of psyche and soma. And she really did bring that contribution, the embodied image. And in my work as well, you know, when I live with dream work and dream images, the images are embodied, breath, pulse. That's who we're deepening our relationship with. They're living images. And that's how I experience that. James Hillman, he brought, just as the book says, a revisioning of psychology from A to Z. You know, psychology as an explanatory system, the work of analysis, he even named a book, Myth of Analysis, that there's something in addition to that, that the autonomy of the psyche, that the images have a life of their own, voices to offer. What is it and how is it that we can come into relationship with the dream on behalf of the dream without being so impositional? It sounds easy when you put it in words like that, but my goodness, you know, to learn the art that Hillman offers of allowing the dream itself to come alive and to have the figures interact on behalf of themselves and to be able to listen to the stories, the offerings, that's something, you know, something really extraordinary. Hmm. That's Marion and James. And who is the third one you mentioned?
Well, Jung, I think, got the whole ball rolling for us moderns.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And we've mentioned Jung. I mean, you know, I think it begins with Jung. It does.
Well, Freud and then Jung. I mean, we could go to Freud maybe, right? But Jung kind of took apart the rigidity of Freudian analysis and started to expand it. And I think Hillman made it even more like emphasize the multiplicity of the psyche and decentralizing the self. You know, he called the monotheism of this of psychology, kind of dispersed that, opened it more, and then Marian brought it like back into the body in a way. So it didn't, because it was getting so theoretical and abstract and conceptual, and people getting hung up on the self and the unconscious and the anima, the animus, and she was like, bring it down. And that's that kind of Canadian aspect of her too. Very like, is, very earthy, like self-deprecating, funny, but also very strong. She was such a great figure. I love her so much.
Mm. Yeah, strong presence. I had the privilege of visiting she and her husband, Ross Woodman, for many, many, many years, both here in Santa Barbara and also in their home place in Canada. Just extraordinary who she is still in imagination, in her work, her body of work. And that's also held at Pacifica, actually, in a place called Opus, which I am now evolving into, as I'm no longer the president CEO of Pacifica. That's been passed on, but now really in a role of elder and a guardian of their works. Through this place called Opus Archives and Library, and the protection, preservation service to allow lots of folks to access their work and to integrate it in their life, their research, their writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I always, you know, it's been a long time dream of mine to spend some serious time in the Opus Archives, spending some time immersed in the work of my spiritual elders. So just throwing it out there, if you ever need like a research assistant, I've got some ideas about what we could do with some of
this conversation
material.
Is perfectly timed. Remember that you offered and I accept, we accept. Yeah, it is really something to be in the archives because it's what's, you know, these authors were reading lots of the books that were important to them, and then they would make little notes in the margins, which you would never see otherwise. But once you start, you're in there for days because it is so inspirational, such a great thing. So a very, very quick story, 1 minute story. The president of Lithuania came to the United States because there's lots going on in Europe, as we know, politically, X, Y, and Z. So he was here, landed in Washington, D.C. There's lots of conferences, conversations going on. He brought the first lady, his wife, and they were touring there. Then they came out to Los Angeles, and there was a series of meetings he had there. He had one thing on his mind, in addition to the politics and the negotiations and the economic issues and all those kinds of things. He loves Maria Gimbutas, who's a mythologist who was born and raised in Lithuania, and he grew up with that mythology. And he wanted to make it a point to make sure to visit while he's here in California, the Opus Archives and Library. A month and a half of talking with Secret Service, right? Talking with the who's who to get this all arranged, to make sure that it was okay and they had the protection. So the day comes and he comes, actually, his whole motorcade. And you can only imagine little flags going, the, you know, all the different...
diplomat plates and all that stuff.
All the stuff and the Highway Patrol, everything, Secret Service, all over. He was so engaged when he was in there because he just, all the her books are there, the original copies, which is what is he's passionate about. Mm. So it was really, really heartfelt and heartful to really be able to spend time in those collections. So I'm so happy that you're interested in spending time and getting engaged in them.
Well, that's so interesting, right? Because a place like that, it's like archives sounds so academic, dry and dusty, bankers' boxes full of papers, but it really is it's a place of tribute, but also like a place of pilgrimage for people who have been touched by these people's work.
Yeah, and when I was each of them individually, the reason that, and so many others, we're naming three or four, but there's many. The reason that their work is here, Joseph Campbell, so many, his whole library is here. Hmm. Steve, you know, want to make sure it's a living archives, not just dusty. And now everything can be digitized too, and you can be online, right? That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is to be able to interact with the actual texts themselves, which is really extraordinary. Also with digitization, so both, but to be actually, to be there in the place, and a lot of the furniture, the desks that they were working on.
Oh, so, wow.
Oh, yeah. So that's present too. It is.
These things that would be infused with their spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. So you really get a felt sense of being present.
Huh. Yeah. Well, we've talked about, you know, this this rich lineage that you come from. What do you think, or what do you hope that your work adds to this this tradition or lineage? What's unique about your work?
Well, that's the question. Let me take a breath.
Ask Captain Ego to move aside.
Yeah, exactly right. And not offer a rehearsed answer, but to be very responsive. I think my great-grandfather was a storyteller, and extraordinary storyteller, and he's influenced everything I've done in my life, truly. And for me, I'd love to have come through me the capacity to open imagination and invite people in a way that allows folks to hear the stories that originate in the figures, the landscapes, right? The creatures, the feelings, the felt sense of imagination, to hear the teaching stories. That would be something that I would feel privileged to do. I taught school for a long, long time, so I have the capacity to create exercises, tools, methods, approaches. So all that I can write down, which I have done in the new book, Imagination Matrix, and of course in Dream Tending, and in my teaching seminars and so on. So I have the capacity to offer the tools, some of the maps, but then to invite people into the imagination, to journey through the realms of the autonomous or deep imagination and listen to the stories that come from an indigenous ground. That would be that's a calling that resonates through me into my lineage and ancestry.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, is you know, your ability to make things accessible that are rooted in a really rich and complex tradition of theory and practice, to make that accessible. The practical element to how to put it into practice. So not only being able to kind of synthesize things and put them in a kind of process or system, but also, like, I've witnessed this is by demonstrating through the practice itself. And so that was a big part of the dream tending training, is actually just doing it live, and noticing kind of your quality of presence and your curiosity and attentiveness, and maybe resisting, or you're just, you don't have to resist anymore, but helping us to learn how to resist those tendencies to interpret and to label and box things in and all of that. So it's both a combination of, I think, like the way of teaching that you might have done. So coming up with exercises and that kind of thing, but also through the practice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's a big part of the way that you show, not just tell. Maybe is a simple way to put it. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
Because we didn't often get to, you know, we didn't get to see Hillman practice his version of imaginal psychology or archetype. I mean, we kind of did on the stage, but it, you know, it's not interactive in that way. And so I think that's really instructive for people, is to see it in action.
Yeah. And I'm more and more really enjoying working with smaller groups of folks where we can be in it. Mm-hmm. So if anybody's interested, just go to dreamtending.com. And we're just, I love that. And particularly, I like doing that at Pacifica, you know. It's right where the ocean is on one side, the hills are on the other side, the mountains mm-hmm. and the sea find each other. The grounds are beautiful. So
it's a liminal place.
Yeah, the place itself, the spirit of place becomes so helpful and part of it all.
Yeah. So I guess that's one of the gifts of being at this stage in your life. Kids are grown, some of your professional responsibilities you've graduated from. And so you're traveling all over, leading dream tending circles around deep imagination. You're doing consultations with different groups. So go to the website. Steve might be coming to a town near you, or
there you go.
A lot of the stuff that you're doing, like the upcoming Pacifica immersions, you're also offering an online component for those as well. Yes. So yeah, lots of ways to get involved.
Yeah, there are. Yeah. And it's, as you started, we both started, so great to be in the community of others that are sharing certain aspects of the journey. It's just supportive and helpful and conversation engaging. It allows imagination to blossom more readily.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's feeling a really deep need that I personally feel is the wanting to belong to a community that is non-dogmatic, that doesn't require me to take on a set of beliefs that might be in conflict with my own beliefs or non-beliefs or my own tradition or anything like that. There's nothing appropriative about it, but it is involved in the depth, just like any spiritual community should be, but it's different in a way in that it revolves around imagination and everybody has something to contribute. It's not, you know, receiving something from on high. And so it's really special and I think fulfills something really necessary in our lives.
Yes. Yeah, that's beautifully said.
Well, thanks a lot, Steve. It was great to finally get the chance to sit down and talk about soul and imagination with you. And I feel like we've done a good job of honoring these spiritual ancestors and also carrying their work forward, which is what they want. Mm-hmm. And so that's wonderful. I'm glad you're out there and I'm really happy to know you.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. And the same for me with you. And I look forward to wandering the Opus archives with you.
Ah, someday.
Yeah, someday.
Right, yeah. Take care. We'll see you down the road.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed this preview and want to hear the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, head on over to patreon.com/howlinthewilderness and join the pack. Thanks for listening.